This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for our show, producers, I should say, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Farrin is at the controls. We are planning here on talking in this second hour of Focus 580, with James Galbraith. He is an economist and perhaps one of the country's most outspoken economists, not only on economic issues, but on political issues as well. He writes often for mainstream and both liberal publications on economic topics. He served on the staff of the Congress of the U.S. in the 80s, eventually as executive director of the Joint Economic Committee. He's been a guest scholar at Brookings Institution. Currently, he's professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs and at the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He's authored a number of books about economics, books that are both intended for reading by people who study economics and also by those who are interested in a more general sense. And he's joining us this morning by telephone, and we'll talk about a number of things about America these days, about the American economy, about who benefits, about who loses, and perhaps how it is we decide what's important and where we want to put our resources. And we're pleased that he could be with us on the program. We've been talking here about having him on the show for a long time, and I'm glad that we could make it happen. As we talk with James Galbraith, the number, if you'd like to call, and certainly we welcome callers, the number to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, or you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455, any place else. And any point here, you can join the conversation. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we could keep moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody is welcome to give us a call. Professor Galbraith, hello. I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Very well, thank you.
Perhaps the place to start out is I'd like to have you talk a little bit about some of the things that you've said generally about American capitalism. And in very strong terms, you've said that you think that what it is that characterizes capitalism in America today is predation. You know, that it's a system that has come to benefit the few at the expense of the many. Something that I suppose that there are people would argue has been the defining feature of capitalism forever. Although, you know, some people also might argue that it's been worse and not so bad at various times. Do you think that somehow that there is something different about our time than as compared to others?
Well, you're quite right that this is not a new idea. One of my favorite American economists, Thorstein Veblen, wrote about it a century ago and in very amusing and graphic terms. But what I'm trying to get across with that idea is that this is something actually a little different from a system in which it's simply a question of the few benefiting at the expense of the many. I think that's basically, as you say, characteristic of all capitalist systems and almost of all economic systems. But what we've seen in the last 25 years, and particularly in the last decade, is a system in which the disciplines and constraints, the systems of ethics, of norms, of business practice, of government practice, that keep predatory behavior under control most of the time, in a society which is being run in an acceptable way, those are broken down, and the result of that, it's not only bad for the many who are consumers, who are workers, who find themselves beset by abusive practices. It's bad for the many business organizations that would normally like to operate within a decent and, I would say, somewhat traditional framework of competent and ethical practice. It's very hard, I mean, just to be very specific about it, it's very hard when the market rewards high flyers who are later shown to be fraudulent, when the market fails to discern a massive corporate fraud at the beginning, for anybody else who's competing with those companies to pursue their ordinary business practice and still survive and still not have their stock market, their stock valuations tank and to come under enormous pressure from Wall Street. So we have a very serious problem, which is not simply a question of, again, talking about corporate fraud as one instance of this, not simply a question of corporate fraud, but of the effects of fraud on the whole climate of business practice in this country. Mm-hmm.
And I think you also make the argument as persuasive that this is not, this doesn't necessarily divide along, concern about this doesn't necessarily divide along party lines, along class lines. It's not just a liberal conservative thing. It's not just a rich poor thing. It's not just a management worker thing, but that there are in fact people who would no doubt identify themselves as conservative Republicans, people whose perspective of that might be of that of management of big business, who would say, you know, we're concerned about this as well because it affects our image, it affects the way in which we operate, and that they would not even in an off the record kind of way, they wouldn't want to identify themselves with the predator state any more than people on the other end would.
Absolutely. And there's no question this is, I think you can take this particular template for thinking about issues and use it in a number of different contexts, one of them being the present war in Iraq. And there one finds many people who are very conservative, very concerned with the state of American institutions, who feel that this particular adventure, this particular fiasco, has done a huge amount of damage to the things that they think are most important and valuable in our society. And I have to say I sympathize with them a great deal. Mm. Don't think it is a partisan issue.
This is obviously, I guess it's a big question, but it's a natural question. And what is, why do you think this has happened? And does this have to do somehow with people in government and the way they think about what government is for, or does this have something to do with a sort of de facto disenfranchisement of people all along the political spectrum, or is it sort of both?
Well, I would answer in two parts. I would say over a long period of time, from the early 1980s through the late 1990s, we've seen a weakening of the norm setting, standard setting forces. We've seen a campaign against government's power to set standards and regulations for business practice. We've seen a campaign against worker rights, against environmental standards. Sometimes that campaign was stronger, let's say, as in the early Reagan administration. Sometimes it was weaker, as in the Clinton administration, which made an effort, and particularly at the end, to strengthen standards. But the whole tenor of that discussion for that 20-year period was totally different from what it had been, let's say, from the 1930s through the early 1970s, through the Nixon and Ford administrations, when there was a feeling that government had a legitimate and indispensable role, and that government was the instrument that you used, in some sense, to get the country pulling together in certain directions that you just thought it was desirable to go. Obviously, Reagan attacked that head on, and succeeded in greatly and basically in demolishing that previous consensus. And so, a very permissive environment developed. What happened then? And here's the second part of my answer: is that in 2000, the reins of state power were seized by a group of people who did not have a strong popular base. They, after all, did not win the election in 2000. It was state power was handed to them by a very narrow majority on the Supreme Court, and they have proceeded to govern in the interest solely of the clientele that backed them in the first place. And that is a very small subset of American politics and even of American economics. It's not all of large corporations. It's not all of business. It's not all, certainly not a majority of the population. It's the interest of the people who are backing them financially, been backing them politically. It's the interest of energy and mining companies, the interests of certain elements of the big media, the interests of certain elements in the big pharmaceutical companies. One could go down the list of who's behind this administration. It is essentially a clientele-based government. And as a result of that, everywhere you look, the policies of this administration have been designed by the clients with a flagrant disregard of the checks and balances and the interests of the broader broader constituencies that have traditionally been represented. They're not represented at all anymore. And that seems to me to be the frank statement of the crisis that we face.
I think that there are many people that would certainly agree with you. They might not be able to articulate the point of view as well as you, but would essentially say that they think that you were right and are dissatisfied for a number of reasons with the direction that this administration and the American government has taken over the last 7 or 8 years. There seems like here there's a natural constituency for anybody who would come along and try to round these people up to support some kind of electoral change. I guess some people would argue that it would be natural perhaps for the Democratic Party to think about that. There may be other parties who face the disadvantages that third parties do who might be able to do that. But it doesn't seem that so far anybody really has been able to do that. And even now in the run-up to the election here, where there seems to be great dissatisfaction out there among the electorate and people talking about the possibility that Democrats might just be able to take control of the House once again, there doesn't seem to be anybody who's really in a position to try to gather up all of those people and to use that as a way of at least getting the foot in the door and being able to get into government and perhaps think about doing something differently. I mean, why is it that seems to be the case?
Well, I worked for a long time in the Congress, and I have a pretty good sense of how that, well, it was a while ago, how that institution was at the time, but also how American politicians are and how they tend to differ from, let's say, European politicians. The systems, of course, totally different. In a parliamentary system, one has people who are essentially career functionaries is too denigrating a word, but career participants in a party structure and whose position in the parliament depends upon standing in an ongoing national political organization to which they rise to the top or they don't. American politicians are, their survival doesn't depend on that at all. They are constituency-based. Members of the House have to win re-election in particular districts, members of the Senate in particular states. They are therefore highly dependent upon the economic constituencies that support them or don't support them. They are independently affected by the mass media in the way in which, as I say, in other democracies is simply not the case. So what this means is it's very hard for a political leader, no matter what they feel in private, to speak as frankly about, to give an independent analysis of the situation, as I'm attempting to do from the safety and security of my university job. That's not what you can expect a political leader in the United States to do. And so what tends to happen and what has happened historically is that the public has to be heard from first. The public has to essentially sweep out one set of rascals and tell the set that comes in, look, we're expecting something fundamentally different from you. We are demanding it. And in fact, if you don't deliver your heads will be on the chopping block next. At that point, you'll expect these, as I say, responsive but vulnerable politicians to start speaking to those concerns and to start addressing them. It's not because they came to an independent position on their own, and you know, if we're looking for a Winston Churchill to stay out in the wilderness and still survive in American politics for 20 years, as Churchill did before he became prime minister in 1940, we're going to be waiting a long time for that. That's not going to happen. What has to happen, and what historically has happened, is that we'll get, to go back to a Franklin Roosevelt, a guy who did not articulate exactly what he was going to do as president until after he was elected, but then faced with a situation in which there was an overwhelming demand for change, he came through and delivered on it.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, economist James Galbraith. He teaches economics and a variety of other subjects at the LBJ School and UT Austin's Department of Government, and also frequently comments on both economic and political issues. He directed the LBJ School's PhD program in public policy in the late 90s. He's currently director of University of Texas Inequality Project. He's authored a number of books, a couple of them textbooks, and also books for a more general readership, among them Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, published in 98, and the book Inequality and Industrial Change, A Global View, in 2000. He's joining us by telephone. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let us talk with someone here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask a couple of questions. One is, I don't hear enough people, and until they do start talking about this, I don't think you're going to get anywhere, and that is people have to start attacking the prestige we give to the financial industries. Essentially, when you're in that industry and you just look at a set of numbers and nothing else, you're given free license to ignore the things that most people think are the most valuable in our civil society. And I'll give you a good illustration of that, and that is that recently, I mean, with the recent commemoration of the September 11th attacks, coinciding with that, that we're talking about the first responders and how they're suffering from having breathed in the asbestos and concrete dust. And but did I hear anybody suggest that perhaps these families who directly benefited from these first responders give up some of the millions and millions of dollars that were contributed and given to them to help these first responders? Not a word. I mean, our values are really messed up. I wanted to ask you directly, though. That was more of a comment, I guess. What argument would you give to someone looking from the outside saying that we don't have a democracy at all? What we really have is a plutocracy, the rule of the wealthy. I don't hear that enough either. Could you speak to that? And I'll hang up because I'm in my car. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Well, okay. Professor Galbraith,
I mean, the comment and the question are very closely related. And it is true that in this society, in our society, bankers and the spokesmen of the financial sector have a disproportionate influence. And they have enjoyed it really since the early 1980s. They had an enormous rise in the economic importance and in the political importance of the financial sector, to the point where it's extremely hard to have a discussion about economic policy, even in the Democratic Party, that is not heavily dominated by the financial point of view. And that showed up. Let me give you a very concrete, I think totally non-controversial example of that, going back to the 1990s, that's leaving aside the present administration altogether. In the Democratic administration that preceded in Clinton's administration, international financial policy was entirely in the hands of a Treasury Department, which was itself entirely dominated by a Wall Street perspective. So it pursued policies which, let's say, were aimed at opening up the Asian economies, Korea, for example, Indonesia, to American banking and insurance interests in a way which led directly to the destabilization and the crisis of the Asian economies in 1997. There were people in the administration, and the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joe Stiglitz was the leading voice and someone who's written about this with great clarity, who said, no, this is not a good idea, not in the long-term interest of the United States. But the policy was not determined on that basis. It was determined on the basis of what is good for the clients of the Treasury Department, and the clients of the Treasury Department were the large institutions of Wall Street. That seems to me to be a very serious sort of problem that, as I said, the caller at least was alluding to, and a very specific example of the kind of thing he was alluding to. Are we in a plutocracy rather than a democracy? Let me bring in here a book which was initially published 3 years ago by Farrar Straus and just been republished by Princeton University Press. It's called A Free Nation Deep in Debt by actually a British investment banker named James McDonald, who makes an argument about the nature of democracy. Democracy is basically as broad as the creditor base of a government. If you go back to Athens, the original democracies, and to the republics, the Italian republics of Genoa and Venice and Florence, what you find is that the substance of citizenship was closely tied in to the ability of the citizen to lend to the state. Right? And so if you held government bonds, in other words, in one form or another, an early form or a modern form, you had a weight in public policy that you didn't otherwise have. And if you look at the 20th century, the financing of the First World War, the financing of the Second World War, particularly in the United States, enormously broadened the base of people who were participating, not only politically by voting, but by lending to the government, by holding government debt. With the result, I mean, these two things are very closely tied, that it's in the aftermath of those two wars that you had the broadest-based democracy and the most progressive social policies we've ever had. What's happened since then, of course, is that's all disappeared. And what you have now is a government which is largely in hock to its banks and to the central banks of places like Japan and China. And that being so, the real responsiveness of the government interests outside the financial sector is extremely curtailed compared to what it was 40 or 50 years ago. I thought the whole argument, which is done with great care and really great talent in this book, was it's very fresh, very original, very impressive. And it gets to that question. A democracy is not just about voting. It's about a much broader base of citizen participation in political decision making. And there, at least at the federal level, we're falling radically short of where we were 40 or 50 years ago. We simply don't have that broad base of participation. At the local and municipal and state level, I think we still do. And the citizens, in fact, do participate more or less directly in a great many financial matters, as anybody who votes on municipal bond issues knows. But at the federal level, these things have become very, very remote from the citizenry.
I have some other callers here I want to get to in just a second, and I hope they won't mind if they wait a minute, because I want to raise a question that's different but connected, and that has to do with the amount of money that we are now spending that comes under the broad umbrella of national security. Certainly, I know that you have been very critical of the administration, critical of the Iraq War. If you look at the amount of money that we have spent, our spending will spend on that and everything else that you can put under that heading, what concerns should we have, particularly about the future and simply just about the enormous amount of resources that this consumes?
Well, I think the basic thing is we're not getting our money's worth. We have you know, the purpose of having a strong military is to buy a secure and peaceful world. And that means you not only have to, there are certain resources you have to devote to that, but you have to devote them in a way which is actually designed to achieve that goal. And this we are not doing and haven't done. In the early part of the present administration, there was a complete fixation on getting a missile defense system in place, a system which is enormously costly and serves absolutely no security purpose, since it's very obvious that if someone wishes to detonate a nuclear explosive on American soil, they won't send it in by a missile, which leaves a very clear return address. They'll bring it in some other way, and that will not be detectable by the missile defense system. It's not the missile, after all, that you're trying to defend against. It's the nuclear warhead. I mean, but this point was completely lost on the in the discussion of that system, and an enormous amount of money was and still is being spent uselessly. That's not only a waste, it's a damage to the national security of the country, because it means that at the same time, we have not been spending on the equipment. For a long time, the equipment that our forces needed in Iraq was absolutely deficient. And the whole stories of Humvees, which did not have sufficient armor to protect them from 50 caliber machine gun bullets or from RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, is a piece of that. A second thing that we're doing wrong here is the deployment of military forces in situations where they probably cannot prevail. You can't put 150,000 young soldiers, no matter how well-equipped and armed they are, into a country of 25 million people, of whom, let's say, 6 or 7 million are completely hostile, and many others are barely tolerant, and expect them to control the country. Is not going to happen. It's going to be a long war of attrition, and one in which ultimately we are going to have to leave with having accomplished really very little, unless political forces break our way, which, as anybody who I think knows the situation in Iraq knows, has not happened. So you're looking at, I am the head of an organization called Economists for Peace and Security, the chair of the board, and we are concerned about the total volume of resources being used. But it's the misuse of resources that concerns me most in the present situation. It's the absolutely counterproductive use of resources, which means at the end of the day that the kinds of things that you would like to have a functioning and efficient army for, you don't have it. You don't have them to conduct the kinds of missions that they might be able to conduct effectively in the modern world. You're, in fact, wasting them in a situation which is damaging that institution and not accomplishing anything for American security.
We have a number of callers. We'll get right back to them in just a second. Very quickly, let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with economist James Galbraith. He teaches economics and a variety of other subjects at the LBJ School at University of Texas, and also at UT Austin's Department of Government. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
In a discussion with a local candidate yesterday, a caller called with the statistics that the top one or upper percentage of the population of income people paid some large fraction of total federal taxes. And I don't know, I'm hoping you could tell me, whether that statistic is correct and whether it's reasonable, as the caller said, that given that fact, we shouldn't stifle the free enterprise of those people, because the more money they make, obviously the more taxes they will pay. Is that correct? Is that an argument that has a flaw in it?
It's an argument. I mean, obviously, since you haven't reproduced the statistic, I can't tell you whether a particular number is correct or not. But in general terms, the proportion of income tax, or income tax plus capital gains tax and other taxes that are levied on the wealthy that are paid by that, let's say, top half of 1%, depends upon two things. It depends upon what the tax rates are, and it depends upon what proportion that group has of total income. And what we've seen in the last few years, really since the mid-1990s, is two things. One is that the share of income that that group has of the total has gone up, while the tax rates have come down. And the result of that is that the if the first force is stronger than the second force, it's quite possible that the share of total taxes being paid by this group is might go up, or it might be relatively stable in spite of the fact that the income tax rates on, let's say, capital gains and dividends have been cut very sharply. Another kind of phenomenon that's clear here is that in the last few years we've had a big surge in corporate profits, which has some good features about it, but it does mean that corporate profits taxes as a share of the total are going to go up. But as I say, it's not because we're taxing them more at a higher rate. In fact, we're taxing them at a lower rate, but we're taxing, they're getting a much bigger share of the total income. It's certainly not an argument that says anything one way or another about the qualities of any particular group of people.
I see. So it might be that though the top 1% or 0.5% is paying as much as 20% of the total federal taxes, it's now because they're getting 40% of the total income in the country.
Yeah, without vouching for any particular figure, that's the gist of it, yeah.
But that argument, what the caller yesterday gave was only half of the details required to make an analysis. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go on. We'll take another. This is line number 3, and the caller here is in Mohammed. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. First of all, I want to say that I appreciate the intellect and the writings of both your father and yourself.
Oh, thank you.
I really believe that the American people do not understand how corporate America portrays us in the world. There's a reason that the United States is intensely disliked or even hated in many places in the world. It has nothing to do with the character of the American people. It has to do with the corporate thrust. The beginning of the 20th century and the end of the 19th century, we had begun on a road of socialism, democratic socialism. And we were diverted from that as time went by. Even though it was a wonderful administration, the Roosevelt administration co-opted many of those ideas. But until we realize that me is we in any society, and until we realize that greed and individual success is not the common denominator for living well in the world, we will not make any progress. And I'd appreciate your comments on that. I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, Professor Galbraith, you can come in any way you like.
It's a very eloquent statement. I appreciate it. The role of American corporations in the world. I mean, give another example. Some years ago, the energy company Enron pressured the Indian government, actually the government of the state in India, the state where the city of Bombay is located, to build an electric power plant. Extremely expensive one, burning, as I believe, natural gas, and producing electricity at rates far above what the electrical consumers of that still very impoverished country could afford. The Indian civil servants in the state of Maharashtra objected violently because they said, you know, this is a white elephant. We're going to spend a lot of money on it, and we, at the end of the day, we're not going to be able to buy the electricity because we won't be able to afford it. So what did Enron do? It enlisted government after government, the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, to bring direct pressure on the Indian government. It made a continuing issue of our relations with India. that we accommodate what Enron wanted, even though it was plainly not in the interests of the Indians themselves. Now, of course, there were some Indians who were on their on Enron's side because they stood to make money out of the construction contracts. But this is the kind of thing that our government needs to stop doing, needs to become substantially more independent and substantially more of a real government and less of a service agency for, to use the term I was using earlier, for a particularly rapacious kind of corporate predator. And that, I think, is a major feature of what damages are standing with the broad populations around the world, where corporations in Latin America and Africa have aggressively gone into the private provision of drinking water. And you see the price of that going up dramatically. The access of poor people to quality drinking water, which basically can only be provided by a uniform municipal system. You can't provide good drinking water out of a truck. You get a clear reason why, let's say, the people of Argentina are very angry about not just American but corporate corporate predation of that particular type in general. One could go on around the world with examples of this. The pricing of vital pharmaceuticals in poor countries, particularly antiretrovirals, dealing with AIDS, is another very well-known example. So we see this. I think we see this a lot, and it does raise a question about not only the conduct of multinational corporations in the United States, but of corporations that represent themselves as being American and are basically the major contact that many people have with America in the rest of the world.
All right. And again, we'll go to another caller. This is someone here back in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? I really admire your work, and I have read some of your stuff over the years. I was going to ask you a question about the derivatives market and such things as the collapse of long-term capital management in the late 90s, where they were bailed out. The world financial system supposedly came under a lot of pressure. And if you could talk about that, but I wanted to just make a comment that about a year ago I was listening to BBC Overnight, and they interviewed a British economist or intellectual, and he said something to the effect that capitalism was actually just institutionalized selfishness. And I wanted to know if you'd ever heard that statement or not, or what you thought of it. And thank you. Like I said again, I really admire your work. Thank you.
No, thanks very much. Well, let's talk a little bit about long-term capital management, a subject I studied quite a bit at the time. Maybe some of your readers, your listeners, don't know about it, so I'll give a little bit of an introduction. Long-term capital management was a firm that was located in Greenwich, Connecticut, that brought together a rather diverse, almost oddball group of high-powered financial talent, including two Nobel Prize winners in economics, and that sold the idea that they had a formula for making a lot of money on the in the financial markets in an extremely safe way, in a way which was very unlikely to fail, and it was basically an exploitation of what they said were certain statistical properties of the financial markets, properties which, incidentally, had been heavily studied at the University of Chicago, were part of a philosophical tradition that had grown up there. And they borrowed an enormous amount, hundreds of millions of dollars, from the major New York banks just down the road in order to place these financial bets, which should have gone, if their models had been right, should have gone well. They should have been able to make pretty good money. They also got a lot of money through this from private investors, but they leveraged it with an enormous amount of bank loans. And what things that shouldn't have happened by their models in a trillion years started happening in 18 months, and the whole thing collapsed with enormous speed. And what happened then was that the Federal Reserve intervened and told the banks that they had to assume the assets. They had to basically take over the portfolio of long-term capital management and work this thing out over time. Otherwise, if the portfolio had to be liquidated abruptly, you would have put quite a number of major banks who should never have been in this business to begin with in a position of real difficulties. I felt at the time that the Federal Reserve's position in actions was fairly reasonable, given that they had failed to regulate this and to prevent this, they'd allowed this situation to develop in the first place, it would not have been in our interest to have a major financial crisis like the, let's say, the October 1987 stock market crash when LTCM collapsed in 1998. But what it revealed is the way in which, as I say, a small group of rather eccentric types, not just these Nobel Prize winners, but some Russian mathematicians and this and that and the other thing, could get into the heart of the financial system and really run amok using selling a financial theory which was not only flawed but known by serious people to be flawed. It was based upon a completely erroneous view of the way and of the statistical properties of financial transactions. Was truly remarkable. It was truly a sign that the this kind of market, the derivatives market, is beyond being governed by the regulatory authorities that we have. And as I say, they did a competent job as firemen when they came in and put out the fire and kept it from spreading once it had happened. But that's a long way from being in a position to control the risks to begin with.
I wonder here, as we get down into our last about 7-8 minutes, if I might ask about something a little bit different. If you take a look at the projected budget, the federal budget for fiscal 2007, and you look at how the spending breaks down, the broad categories where we're putting the money, the number one thing, the most money, goes to Social Security. Next comes defense, then Medicare, then unemployment and welfare, and then Medicaid and other health-related costs. So if you look at four out of the five top categories where the money goes, they're social welfare programs. We know that in the future, I think we expect that the amount of money that will be required to take care of these programs is going to grow. And if you ask people, well, what do we do about that? I think a lot of people, the first thing they say is, well, at least people on the left, they say, well, we should cut our defense spending. And even if we cut that in half and, you know, that would get us $330 billion, that when you look at the total amounts of money that we're spending on these things, you have to wonder whether that would make very much difference. What do we do about what seems to be a looming crisis when it comes to paying for social programs that almost everybody agrees are worthwhile and should be maintained? I mean, I know this is the age-old guns and butter question. How do you think that we're going to be able to deal with this in the next, 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, I'll change my tune a little bit on having been gloomy for most of the hour. There isn't a looming crisis in Social Security. And there's a real distinction here between the kinds of things that you described on the social side, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, on the one side, and the national defense sector on the other. The first three are, by and large, social insurance schemes. They are ways in which the federal government transfers funds from one part of the population to another. In the Social Security program, it's a transfer nominally from people who are paying payroll tax to the elderly. But you've got to be a little careful about that, because people who are paying payroll tax, if there were no Social Security system, they would be supporting their own parents, right? Mm-hmm. So they would not necessarily be better off than they are now. So you have to ask, who is really better off? It's old people who don't have kids who would otherwise support them. And it's young people who have parents who find that other young people who don't have parents to support are paying the payroll taxes that support everybody's living parents. That's where the way the transfers actually work in the society. That's a system which is perfectly sustainable. It is not a user of real resources. It's not the Federal Reserve kind of, the federal government gobbling up money. It is simply spreading purchasing power, which exists in the population, out over a group of people, the elderly, who are no longer working support themselves, but who did work in the past, and who we consider are entitled to a certain very modest standard of living. There's no question in the world that we can sustain that as long as we like as an economic matter. Military side is something else entirely. That is real goods and services which are being purchased by the government and being used up. And if you did something else with that equipment, with those resources, with that talent, with a huge amount of human talent, by the way, which is the major asset the military has, it's a hugely successful training institution, then, you know, there are certain problems that you could address that we're obviously failing to address. A very mundane, very straightforward, very well-known example. When Katrina destroyed the city of New Orleans a year ago, it destroyed that city because the levees were not adequately maintained. The budget, the responsibility for doing that was with the Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps of Engineers budget for this purpose had been cut. Why? Because there were other demands on Army resources, in particular Iraq. Going into the rescue operation, the helicopters that were required for that rescue operation should have been with the Louisiana National Guard in Louisiana, but they weren't. They were in Iraq along with a large fraction of the Louisiana National Guard. Those are problems which where there's a sort of direct competition for resources, and where massive failures on the domestic scene can be traced directly to the way in which those resources are being used. It's not true for Social Security. Social Security is simply, a way of assuring that no matter how long you live, if you've worked in this country for a certain minimum period of time, then, you know, you're not going to be in dire and abject poverty. And we can certainly afford that.
Well, can I just, because with Social Security, what we're told, what seems to concern a lot of people, is that the numbers of people who are drawing benefits will outpace the numbers of people who are employed and who are paying into the system.
It's a false argument, because with overall productivity rising, the standards of living of both parts of the population can easily rise and should rise as time goes on. As the number of elderly grows relative to the working population, one of the things that happens is the number of children declines. So you may want to shift social resources away from schools, kindergartens, and toward senior centers and nursing homes. But that's just because of the demography of the country as it is, and it's not something which is unmanageable any more than the baby boom was unmanageable. We built a lot of schools to take care of the fact that there were a whole lot more kids when I was a kid than there are now or there were before. Big deal.
And so, you again, just to round us out, you're not worried about the idea that various kinds of social costs aren't getting to the point where that they're, if you add all of these sorts of things together, aren't getting to the point where, or not going to get to the point where it's we're going to be overwhelmed by them?
We're not going to be overwhelmed by them, no. We need to worry about the cost of pharmaceuticals because too much of that money is going to the big drug companies. We need to worry about the cost of insurance and medical care, because that's a pure waste, something we could easily save on. Save a lot of money for a lot of people at the expense of a lot of money for a very small number of people. We need to worry about Social Security privatization schemes, because they're basically a way in which certain elements, predatory elements in the financial sector, seek to skim from the revenues that would otherwise be distributed to elderly people, seek to make the life experiences of the elderly much more risky than they are now. Those are problems. Those are the real problems of these programs. The overall burden of the resources on the population is just totally manageable.
And over, just very quickly, are you overall optimistic about the economic future of the country?
I try to maintain a completely even emotional keel and have neither optimism nor pessimism.
Well, at that, we will leave it with our thanks to James Galbraith. He teaches economics and a variety of other subjects at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, where he also is in the Department of Government. He has authored a number of books, textbooks, and books for a general readership, and we're very pleased that he could give some time. Professor Galbraith, thank you very much for talking with us
today. My pleasure.